Pod. 22 Pod. Yeah, just talk about the film, really. How did he come to be involved in this? And just a bit about your background, really.
Well, it's been quite a long project. It started many, many years ago.
Someone clicking a pen.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. That's my there we go. Give me ticks just thinking about it. But me and Dave used to run a company together, and one of our ideas was to do a series on the Towers of London, which we did for Bravo, which was kick-started when Dave came back very excitedly from a festival. Over to Dave and his anecdote.
I think it was the Download Festival where I was interviewing someone just as a sort of freelance gig. And me and the crew went into the VIP room after our shoot was finished, just have a few beers. Well, that's where all the bands were hanging out backstage, not really a VIP room. The Towers of London turned up, having played a show, I think, on one of the smaller stages, and they looked just unbelievable. Like, they really stood out. They looked insane. And they were clearly bent on causing trouble, like back-combed hair, really punky look, crazy sunglasses off their faces. They just basically provoked a huge fight involving random roadies and bands, and the whole thing kicked off, and all the sort of TV and filming people were cowering around the sides, and the rock and roll people were all getting involved, like a barroom brawl. And then in the middle of it, I saw the lead singer tap the bass player on the shoulder, who I think was punching someone. And he turned around, and the lead singer got out some hair mousse and started rearranging his hair. I thought, right in the middle of the fight, and I thought, well, this is a very unique thing to see. I need to find out who these guys are, see if we can do some filming. So, yeah. I mean, the principle being, if you can't stop staring at it in real life, then maybe it's worth filming it because it'd be interesting on screen.
Yeah, sure, yeah. And you say you're working for Bravo at the time?
No, we had our own production company, but we were doing series for Bravo. They were one of our clients. But we were doing all kinds of stuff. That wasn't a Bravo shoot. It was a Sharon Osbourne interview for an American company. Just a quick pickup.
We had a small indie, and we did Touch the Truck for Channel 5 at the time. Some crazy ass endurance show with Dale Winton that got a bit of sort of publicity and, you know, stuff. And so we were just looking out, we were just drawn to left field ideas, I think. So when Dave came back and go, oh, there was this story, and there was this fight and a thingy, and there was this band, and then they stopped, and then there was like hair mousse, and I was going, you know, I'd worked for MTV for years, but that sort of captivated me as a sort of anecdote. So then it was like, oh, let's just track the band down, see if they want to do something. And then we tracked down, because they were managed by Nathan McGough at the time. Obviously, a happy Monday. So then we had to go and meet him. And then it was a long old thing, because they didn't want to do it. Like, oh, fuck off. You're just TV. What do you want to do? You know, it was like a very sort of negative approach. But then we managed to cut together a little showreel sizzle thing, showed it to Bravo without really even having the band's commitment. I think it was one of those where we told everyone that we had the commitment, where we didn't really. So I think we went to the went to the TV channel with the sizzle, going, oh yeah, we got this brilliant band, and then we said to the band, oh, we got this kind of TV series commissioned without having got it commissioned, and then eventually managed to get enough money to and then get them on side, and we did like 10 half hours, and then that did quite well. And then, you know, like cut to about 15 years later, when me and Dave had sort of parted ways a long time ago. But I was just like, oh, I always thought there was more to do with the Towers of London. You know, maybe there's a featured documentary in that. I wonder what they're doing now. And so then I tracked them down, and like, lo and behold, they were still sort of relatively together, or at least were still dreaming of becoming international punk rock superstars. Whilst not really having the fame or the money to sort of back it up. But then also Donnie, you know, was also a trained Reiki therapist. So it just all sounded so kind of bizarre. It was like, right, we've got to do something. So I spoke to Dave, and then we got back together, and then we spoke to the band, and then it was like, all right, let's see if we can make this work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I remember watching it back in the day.
Did you?
Oh,
yeah,
great.
Yeah. Well, definitely me and my mate used to watch a clip. It must have been on YouTube in about 2006, around the time it had been out. We used to always watch a clip of the fight in the street because some of the quotes from that were amazing.
The fight in Peterborough.
Yeah, it was just like, I don't want to fight you though, mate.
Oh, like the chicken legs and all
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. Was that just... That guy just carrying a can of booze around, trying to like, it's funny. Man.
Yeah, he was more upset about his booze, wasn't it? It was like, give me back my can of beer.
But were you two there then at all times with them then, during the filming?
No, we weren't there with them at all times. Oh, okay. We were there a lot of the time. Like I was with them for the first 2 or 3 months of the filming. It's pretty intense to be with them the whole time. And I fairly quickly worked out that it's going to work a lot better if I had sort of rotating people going in, took a step back and just tried to keep an eye on how the story was developing. Because, you know, when a band like that is on tour, it is pretty intense. Tempers fray and you don't get a lot of sleep. So it's difficult to stay on top of what's happening and be able to see the wood for the trees whilst being with the band at the same time. But yeah, we had a couple of brilliant guys who basically did shifts with them.
Oh, okay.
It's not an easy job to do because you want the, you know, you want the exciting stuff, but you can't really get involved in any of that when you're the TV person. So it's quite a tricky role to play. It's quite exhausting.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, like, there's obviously this balance of, you know, being a documentary, but also, like, I was reading the description earlier, and it's kind of like people might not know if it's a comedy film. Obviously, you reference your Spinal Tap and stuff. So, like, just that in terms of having the trust of the band, but also what you want as the outcome for the documentary back in the for the TV program back in the day, and the documentary kind of that funny aspect. Was it kind of hard to balance those?
Well, I think a lot of that flowed from the band because people didn't know whether the band were taking the piss or not. And they were quite tongue-in-cheek and very ironic. And they never said they were taking the piss, but people suspected they were. And so I think the way we filmed it came out of the personality of the band as much as anything else. And, you know, at the time, they were getting tons of press and they were seen as one of the, you know, potential next big things. But even then, the journalists didn't know, couldn't work out whether, you know, is this a joke or are they serious? Or is it something else that we haven't, like, worked out yet?
No, yeah, for sure. And, like, in terms of the music, were you, like, particularly into their music or any music of the time?
At that, you know, the shows were absolutely amazing. And I used to love encouraging people to go to the shows because whoever it was, you couldn't not love the show. Because you just didn't know what was going to happen next. The energy was incredible and the whole thing felt out of control. And they're still like that now, you know. They just can get an incredible buzz in the room, which was really the point of them. Like, you had to go and see them live because it was that sort of old-fashioned rock and roll that works best, well, for me, works best when you're in the room rather than on the records. Because it's got the unpredictable live angle, people sort of dangling from the ceiling, dancing on the bars and all of that. And in context, a lot of the music at that time was very sort of sensible and sincere. So they did feel quite different to a lot of what else was going on.
Yeah, I suppose it kind of reintroduced the idea of hair metal when I guess all the other bands would have suggested it wasn't very cool, but they kind of had an attitude where they didn't really care about that, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, that was sort of their winning strategy, but also sort of their losing strategy, wasn't it? Because they looked, like, out of time and place. So people, you know, like, so many people just go, oh, they're a bunch of cunts, without just based on what they look like. And it was like, oh, they're just kind of being, you know, like, they're dressing like their Motley Crue. And it's like, that wasn't sort of seen as the right thing to do at the time. But obviously it was that, I mean, they were telling us how they always wanted to have like those skinny tight jeans. You know, they were playing the first gigs around like where I still live, like Shoreditch and Hackney, and they were getting a bit of a crowd. But you could not buy skinny jeans. They had to go to the market in Camden and get someone specially to kind of make the jeans for them, that skinny and tight. You know, but then within like 3 or 4 years, it was like everyone was wearing skinny jeans, wasn't it? So in a way, they were sort of ahead of their time. But at the time, you know, people just sort of immediately kind of go, well, they're a bunch of dicks, just because of their look. But then they loved it at the same time, because they really did walk around looking like that. It wasn't like, you know, like Dexys Midnight Runners. I remember, you know, when they wore all their sort of dungaree kind of stuff, and they used to turn up to the stories of them turning up to top of the Pops in like normal kind of gear, and then they changed into their sort of dungaree outfits for their kind of performance. But I mean, Towers of London didn't put on the skinny jeans and do their hair when they went. I mean, they lived that. They walked down the street like that. I mean, that's why they got into so many fights, because they just walk around wherever they were dressed like that. So I mean, there was a sort of an honesty and a purity to them, which I still sort of really respect, even though, you know, because they really got caned for it.
Yeah, they don't. When you watch the old footage now, they don't look so weird, because people are used to blokes in skinny jeans. But back then, they had to buy their jeans at ladies' clothes shops. That's literally what they did, or take stuff to have it fixed up by a mender. And then when you're looking through the old footage, you see the crew and everyone around them, the roadies, everyone, the audience, are all in seriously baggy jeans, baggy t-shirts, trainers. And they're in these super tight jeans with like high heeled boots and skinny jackets. Like, nobody around looked like that. They really did stand out wherever we went.
Yeah. And, you know, we mentioned the fighting, and yeah, you have to say they did back it up. They did take people on when they needed to, kind of thing. Yeah.
I think
they were living it. They were definitely living it. There was a purity to it. They always sort of saw themselves as outsiders and defenders of outsiders. You know, they were sort of defending the right to dress how you want to do, and you shouldn't have to take shit for it.
But yeah, so they had a policy, which was probably slightly too subtle for the tabloid newspapers and the music press to get at the time, but it was completely consistent, their policy, which was that they didn't ever actually start a fight. What happened was, they wouldn't ever take any abuse off anyone. If anyone shouted something at them in the street, they would never just walk away. They would always confront that person back, and then it would turn into a fight. And that was real and consistent, that policy. And they were just, for some mad reason, happy to do that 7 days a week. So looking like that, I mean, it says it in the film, it's fine looking like that in Shoreditch, but if you go to a town like Peterborough dressed like that, people will shout stuff at you in the street. And if you can't let that go, and you're going to walk over and say, yeah, what, then, you know, you will end up in these physical bust-ups the whole time.
Yeah.
But I remember Rev saying that, you know, like, people really celebrated him for that. He said, like, at concerts, there was one concert where someone came up to him and gave him these kind of badges, which says the Chav Fighter or the Chav Buster, because he'd kind of hit that Chav in the streets of Peterborough. You know, he was seen as a sort of a hero for it among some people.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways to look at them, and one way people look at them is, if you're someone who looks different in a small town, then they're kind of fighting on your behalf. If you're too scared to stand up for yourself, but you want to look a bit different, they're kind of representing you. And that was something we heard a lot, wasn't it, Glenn, at that time?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're not to everyone's taste. I'd fully admit that. I expect they would admit. But, I mean, there is a sort of an honesty and a purity to them that I still sort of respect. Mm. It's the same with their songs. I mean, they're not, like, clever songs, are they? They're pretty simplistic songs, like a lot of sort of punk is. We're sort of just kind of chanty, catchy choruses. Which, I mean, if you were analysing the intricacies of songwriting, probably wouldn't be very high up. But you know, Dave's right. In a live arena, in a dirty, scummy, kind of piss-stained, you know, beer-soaked, grotty club on a Saturday night, you know, they're pretty good entertainment.
And how did you find them personally? Just because even in the trailer for the documentary, you know, you see the bravado quickly followed by, you know, a moment of honesty where I think one of them says he needs a toilet after giving it the big one. Like, did you find them quite nicest people when you got to know them, kind of thing, or quite, you know, quite good blokes?
Glenn?
Let's just say we have a complicated relationship with the band.
Right, okay.
They're very, very sweet in real life. I'm sure lots of people who are, you know, don't mind having a fight have a sweet side too. And then when you're sort of involved with them professionally and you're part of their image, then that, you know, is a very complicated relationship. And I think people, I don't know, I think it, when you become famous and notorious like that, I think you have a love-hate relationship with it. I think some days you're really up for it, and then other days you wish you could switch it off. So yeah, it's complicated, like Glenn said.
I mean, deep down, they are really, you know, they're lovely people and they got good hearts. But yeah, I mean, I think like all these things, you like I said, it wasn't like, right, we're not these kind of people. We're like posh boys and we're going to pretend to be kind of these urban oiks and kind of go around fighting. It wasn't like that. I mean, what you see is what they are. If, you know, a more extended version of maybe one side of one's character. But, you know, when you've sort of been living that and performing that role for, you know, decades now, it becomes quite blurred, doesn't it? And sometimes you don't necessarily want to be that, you don't want to present that bit of you to the world, because you go like, hold on a minute, it's a really nice kind of person over here who's quite into Reiki and, you know, like spirituality, but you're still sort of seen as this other kind of thing. It's complicated. Like a lot of people in front of the camera or musicians who deal with, I think, isn't it? You sort of, you're seen in a certain lens and you realise that that's the persona and people, you're only famous because of that, but you don't necessarily want to perform that all the time. So if you get them, yeah, so what I would say is like, if you get them on the right day, lovely people. If you get them on the wrong day, maybe, you know, it's not quite such a pleasant hour.
Yeah, fair enough. And then in terms of getting the documentary together, then, like you mentioned with the TV show, they weren't particularly keen at first. What was the reaction with this?
They didn't want to do it at all. And so it was one of the quickest sales we did to Bravo. Like, we sent in a little reel that we'd done, and they rang us back within 3 or 4 days and said they definitely wanted to do it. And it's normally the other way around. It's normally easy to persuade the band or the talent to do it and really difficult and competitive to get it on telly. This one, it was exactly the opposite way around. Bravo really wanted it. They didn't want to do it. But I think that's just because they were just about to hit their peak of notoriety. And, you know, sensibly from their point of view, at the time it seemed like the sky was the limit. They didn't know what offers they were going to get next because there's so much press about them. So I think it was more just them, you know, thinking, well, let's wait and see. These guys want to do us on, put us on Bravo. Maybe somebody else wants to do something else. Let's see what other offers come up. And so that went on for at least a year until we managed to persuade them to do it. But yeah, they didn't really want to do it.
Well, they didn't want to do the series. And then when it came to, you know, like 15 years later, going, do you want to do a documentary? They were sort of, because I had those initial conversations, they were sort of excited by it, but then it was the same thing about like, well, yeah, but do we want to do it? It's nice that we do it, but then hold a minute, what, you're going to use all that old footage of all those things where, you know, I mean, it's some pretty, you know, it's like being, you followed around in your 20s and everything bad that you've ever done is on camera for posterity. And then, you know, you're a bit older and a little bit wiser. And then someone says, you know, all that stuff that you did like 15 years ago, should we just put it all together in a film so that like everyone kind of watch it? And you're kind of going, yeah, that's quite a good idea because, you know, it was quite funny and it would be nice and I'll get some publicity out of it. And at the same time, you go, but hold on a minute, I'm not that same person I was now. And now you're going to bring it all up and then I'm going to be shown to the world. And that maybe is not reflect. So it took a bit of negotiating to sort of get their input to do it.
Okay. Did they all agree to be interviewed for it kind of thing?
Yeah,
they do. Yeah. I mean, okay, you know, it's kind of, I guess it's the same everywhere, but it seems particularly in Britain, whatever you do, if you do anything publicly, people will pop up and say appalling stuff about you. And that's just how we are, isn't it? as a nation, and that sort of tall poppy hating thing. So, you know, when you commit to doing something like that, you are committing to the good and the bad of some people are going to love it, other people are going to hate it, and you're going to have to listen to this stuff. And at times, you know, you're not going to want to hear it, but that's just the reality of putting something out there.
Yeah. And I imagine
Have you actually watched it, Harry? Have you seen it?
No, I've not been given access to it now.
Oh, well, it's a shame. because you'd see that there's sort of a moment in it where we sit them down and show them the worst bits of their behavior many years previous. And that's quite illuminating. You know,
yeah, I was going
to
say,
react to that.
It's almost like, did you see this process in front of you, of them like kind of processing what happened? And
yeah, it becomes therapy. Yeah. It becomes like this is an on-screen band therapy. Because yeah. Also, what's key to point out is that when I track them down, because the series, you know, I don't think we're giving away a big plot twist, maybe, but you know, like, the series ends with the band having a massive fight on the streets of Japan. And Rev, the guitarist, being sacked from the band. And when I tracked them down like 15, 16 years later, they still weren't speaking to the guitarist. So, you know, there was some healing that needed to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realise you hadn't seen it, Harry. I'll send you a link to it after when we're done.
Yeah, oh, amazing. Cheers, mate.
You should have said, because, you know, you'd probably be more... illuminating conversation.
Well, we could do half now. I could send it you after this conversation. You could have a look and then we could do another half hour later if you want.
Yeah,
I think you'd really enjoy it, Harry.
I'd be up for that, mate, yeah. I'm quite new to these things. I was only recently sent a book before it was released as well. But I was hoping the production company would mention it, but it didn't get mentioned. But yeah, we can do that, mate. I'd be up for that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'll send you a link after this.
Brilliant. Yeah, I just wondered what the catalyst was for you two in terms of, you know, like you say, you said you hadn't worked with each other for a while. Yeah, what was the catalyst for doing the project?
The fact that we both knew that it was different to all the other stuff that we'd done, that there was more depth to it, that we'd... So, when we made the series for Bravo, it was like a formatted slot where there was a certain product that they knew would work with their audience at that time of day after the pub, you know, and it was all sort of chopped up for ads and coming up after the break, before the break. And we wanted a certain amount of craziness in each episode and all of that. And then the other thing, we were putting the programs out before the story had really happened. Because we were on program 8 or 9 in the edit before things started to really get out of control. So we didn't know that was going to happen when we started making the shows. We didn't know what the story was, if you see what I mean, when we started making the series. And then looking back and you think, there's actually a much bigger, more serious, real story in this footage than we realised when we were started or that was relevant to make for that TV show. And it was, I think we both just agreed that it was worth taking another look at it. With the benefit of hindsight, having a look at what the real story was. And as Glenn said, once Glenn had found out what the band were doing now, that just gave it an extra... What they were doing in the present day was just really, really interesting compared to what had happened before. So for those reasons, it was worth digging through it again.
I think I was attracted to the fact that, you know, feature docs have become increasingly popular. There's, you know, it's quite a market for them. But a lot of them are quite dry and sober kind of affairs, and this one's humorous. You know, there's not many funny feature docs you do, you know, and so people consistently go, oh, it's like the real Spinal Tap. Just thought, like, well, a funny feature doc would be quite good. And as Fenton Bailey, I think it was, who came on as the executive producer, he's like top TV cheese, you know, does RuPaul's Drag Race. He loved the idea. He said, how many times do you do a feature doc about an unsuccessful band? I mean, you know, like music documentaries are traditionally about like bands that were famous and successful, but to effectively do one about one that didn't really make it, or, you know, only made it for a very small kind of moment, like one summer type thing, and then faded into obscurity in many ways. It sort of just felt like a sort of a counterintuitive sort of film to make. So, I mean, in a way, it's more about the story of like five mates.
You know, yeah, yeah.
Friendship and, you know, beer mates, and then quite frankly falling out in the most kind of horrific circumstances. I mean, you're all falling out with your mate, but not many people have had like a full-on fight in the middle of a Japanese street, been kicked to shit, told to be a cunt, and then you know, and it's all filmed on camera. So that's just sort of like, well, how'd you come back from that? I mean, you know, that's
whilst there's this like £1 million contract on the table that's getting lost kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that was, yeah, I mean, that's the other way of looking at it. I mean, that's why you have to call it Fuck It Up, really. It's like, you know, but first it was like almost like the last time a band would ever kind of be offered a 5-album record deal. You know, I mean, you tell young people now and they go, what? People sort of got given money for album deals and stuff. It's sort of such an alien kind of thing. And then to be given all that money and essentially fuck it up, you know, in broad sense. It's like, how'd you go about that? You know, was it circumstance? Or was it, there's something, you know, there's something very sort of compelling about a sort of a self-destructive entity, which they were in a way. I mean, the things that sort of made them successful were also the things that I think sort of were their downfall as well. In many, you know, so it's sort of interesting territory for us, you know, if you want to make films.
All right, then. Well, let's leave it there, then, if you want, and then I can watch it. And
yeah, I'll literally send you the link now, and okay, then have brilliant. A look, and then yeah, let's do another little bit when you've seen it, if you want.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds good. Thanks for that.
You're welcome, man.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
All right.
Nice one. Cheers, guys.
Well, thanks for supporting us.
Nah, honestly, as soon as I heard about it, it's been a while. I saw something about a year ago, I think, on the internet. And I was like, me and my mates are like, I can't wait for this. So, yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing what you think of it all.
Yeah, cheers. I'll be in touch.
All right. Cheers, Harry. Nice to meet you.
And you, yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod.
So look, I'm glad I sent you the link. I didn't even realise you hadn't seen it until quite late in the conversation.
Yeah, like you said, now I've watched it, I can ask a few more specific questions, really.
Yeah. So what did you think then? Tell me, you can be completely honest, because it's really interesting to hear.
Yeah. I honestly really enjoyed it. I thought it had kind of a lot of components you need for like a compelling story. You've got like the narrative of the band breaking up and kind of reuniting at the end, and then you've got the comedy aspect. You've got kind of this the mask that slips very quickly from the band. Yeah. It's got a lot going on. Yeah, it's exactly what I hoped it would be, to be honest. And even more, like I found the actual story a lot more compelling than I thought I would, in terms of, you know, how Donnie and Dirk treated you know, the likes of Rev. I didn't really see that coming, to be honest.
Yeah, so it starts off as one thing and then turns into something else, doesn't it? So the first cut we did, you know, we had hours of just lunacy, and then we worked out that you can't run that for more than about 40 minutes. It becomes meaningless and you have to sort of move on. And then luckily the present day is actually really interesting, and it does link back to everything that went before, but it kind of goes into a different chapter, doesn't it? Like, it kind of like gets dark in the middle, and then it comes around, and you end up, like, amazingly, you end up feeling quite good at the end of it. Which I didn't know if we'd managed to pull that off, but a lot of people say, actually, I really enjoyed the ending. I enjoyed sort of walking away from it feeling slightly uplifted. And I would never have thought that when I started watching it. And then I love the fact that people don't know whether they're real or not in the opening 10 or 15 minutes, because you could read it that they're acting to begin with. But then when it gets dark in the middle, it just becomes really obvious that they're not acting. And it kind of sort of hopefully sort of dawns on you that actually this is actually really happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that today, like, obviously the Spinal Tap Link. It really, like, some of the lines, you couldn't write them if you tried. But there's so many of them as well. It's just like non-stop funny lines, like unintentionally funny.
Yeah, people couldn't work out whether they were taking the piss or not. And I think a few journalists say that in the film. And they got accused, they constantly got accused of being fake and sort of acting these roles. But then you think, like, you know, all those classic bands like Motley Crue, it is a pantomime performance to some extent, isn't it? It has to be. Then it is about having a performance. So why is one band genuine and one band fake, and who's to decide that? And I think we thought perhaps maybe in sort of UK culture, you're not allowed to be a punk band unless you were in that original sort of late 70s time. And if you weren't happening to do your thing in that time, if you're doing it later, then you don't really count and you're faking it, because you could only be real if you were at that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think the music has a lot to do with that, doesn't it? Like,
yeah.
Weirdly, the song Fuck It Up, it's actually like really grown on me from watching the film.
Yeah.
But I guess it's funny when they're reading the reviews. I think one, he's reading one out and it kind of really sums them up. I think kind of the novelty act that's kind of just a landfill of rock music with a few good elements. And he's just like, oh, it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. Well, you work really hard on stuff and then you've got to throw it out there. And then whatever it is, there's going to be people that really hate it, and you're going to hear about it. And it's a sort of painful moment. That moment of, you know, revealing what you spent all that time working on, that you obviously really care about it, or you wouldn't have put in the work to do it.
Yeah, and I guess that's where their front comes in, doesn't it? It's like, that's when it's going to kick in that we don't care, or reviews, we don't care. That's when they've got a kind of front up to it, I think.
Yeah, and the fine line between sort of making it and not making it. Because when I was first started working in telly as a jobbing sort of freelance producer, I got sent to film loads of bands that were going to be the next massive thing. And generally, they are absolutely brilliant, and you get really buzzed up, and they've got, you know, a great look, brilliant songs, what seems like the whole package, and then you never hear from them ever again, because there's not room for everyone to get their heads around 100,000 bands. There can only be a few. I don't even know, but one time a dozen, I don't know. So all of those guys that didn't quite make it could have been absolutely brilliant, but you just never get to hear it. And you know, that it's a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's some facts at the beginning, isn't there, on the screen?
Yeah, of how unlikely it is. And how it can be just things that are just not in your control at all. Like, for example, maybe you get spotted by somebody who signs you up and then leaves the label randomly, and the next person coming in can't pick up their acts. They have to make their own impression. So just through the revolving door of other people's careers, you could get shelved. Like, there's a whole load of things that you're not in control of that could determine whether you end up being massive or not.
Yeah, we've had previous guests that have talked about that, like the A&R guy that they have leaves and suddenly they feel a bit homeless kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, and then I suppose there's the other thing that, like, so they do those amazing shows in Japan and there's packed, I mean, they're not massive auditoriums, but they're packed. You see, everyone loves it. They all know all the words, and it's not like a failure to have that experience to go and play your music to crowds that are loving it. It's just a brilliant way to earn a living. But somehow you're kind of judged on whether you become absolutely massive in that industry, aren't you? Whereas if you were a kind of competent commercial lawyer, you can be a success. There can be, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of you will be beavering away, getting paid well, having a nice house, and you feel like you've done all right. But in the music business, unless in Britain, unless you're absolutely massive, it's like, well, you know, you didn't make it. But I think to get paid to play your own songs to, you know, rocking clubs is a success, isn't it?
Yeah, that's been a big thing on the podcast. Like, the actual experience of being able to do it for a lot of people was the main thing when they reflect. But I guess, watching this, there are a few missed opportunities that must maybe they don't eat away at them, but you know, you think, if you'd have done that, maybe it might have been different kind of thing. I don't know.
I think they don't remember a lot.
Obviously the Germany thing, and yeah, there's two occasions in Germany, isn't one at a festival and then one on the tour where they just can't play.
Yeah, so hitting the fine line of being
wild and crazy to the point where the press want to write about you, but keeping it so that you can function in the industry and knowing where that line is. But you know, without that it wouldn't be a very interesting film though, would it?
No, I mean, it's great for the film. Exactly. I just mean in terms of their career, but yeah. But yeah, I'd wanted to ask, like, I mean, right at the beginning of the film, I'm pretty sure you're asking the questions when they're all sat at that, like, country manor place.
That's right, yeah.
It's quite funny. And I mean, straight away, I think you ask a question, and I think Rev calls you a cunt straight off the bat. So, I mean,
yeah.
Did you know what you were kind of dealing with straight away, or did that affect you in any way?
What, do I mind being called a cunt? You get really thick-skinned about what you're getting on camera, and if you believe in the project, you'll put up with practically anything, like from the crew as well as the contributors. And like, I didn't know them very well at that point, but that's good because they probably wouldn't say that now. And it's funny, isn't it? But I remember wanting to sort of deliberately give it a Spinal Tap look, because you know, I don't even remember in Spinal Tap they're in a castle. There's something quite funny about that English rock and castles vibe. So I wanted to interview them with some sort of a stately home vibe, but with them with their look. And yeah, they didn't trust me at all at that point.
Right. Okay.
And so I think it is kind of genuine. I mean, I don't think he's... Well, I think he's probably saying it to be funny, but also means it at the same time. Because I think one of the interviewees said they were a bit like a sort of little football hooligan firm where, like, everyone hates us, but we don't care. And if you're not inside the crew, then you're an outsider. So you sort of treat him with suspicion. Maybe it was to do with that.
And yeah, I mean, it's just good seeing, so used to seeing the footage on YouTube, that actually seeing it in good quality was great as well.
Yeah, I don't know how much of it is on YouTube, because I've seen, well, people have told me that there's loads of people claim that thing was staged. And when you see the whole thing, like...
What, the fight?
Yeah.
Right.
I just don't think you could think that. If you just saw the end of it, you could think that. But I think if you've seen how the whole thing unfolds... I just don't see how you could possibly stage that.
No, definitely
I think
not.
It's so real and so like what we discussed this in the last call, but what England can be like if you look a bit weird.
Well, exactly. I think anyone who's been around city centres in England would, you know, it's easy to see how that could happen.
Yeah, and I'm told that hasn't changed at all. It's still the same now. Like, we haven't really moved on from that. It's so, like, if you look different, that means you rate yourself, I suppose. People take, otherwise, why don't you dress like everybody else? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing about British culture, and it is like knocking each other down. If you can't allow someone to think they're any better than you, kind of thing.
Yeah. And just by wearing an unusual outfit, that's read that you're saying you're better than everybody else.
And then, yeah, I was just interested in, you know, there's no narrator. It's just words on the screen. Is that quite deliberate? Because obviously... Actually, it worked quite well in terms of comic timing, because like you can build stuff up. You can have the band, I think, you know, when they're playing the radio show, and Derek's going into detail about how, you know, complex it can be, and then it just cuts to some words saying, "Yeah, the radio show never played the song." Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, you know, it's easy to. Technically, it's very easy to make something quickly if you've got a voiceover. Because you can just record yourself saying the story and then bang shots in and then just lift up the sync to illustrate what you're saying. And to build a scene just out of the footage without anyone saying anything, it's got to be 10 times the amount of work. But it's just so much more powerful to allow people to make their own mind up. And it's very, very heavy-handed to... be telling this story, because then you can't help but sort of tell everybody what to think, and there's not room for people to think, you know, are these guys real or not? To get away with that, you've got to just let it unfold. And the hardest thing is in a lot of the footage, there's so much going on in a scene that you can't really control what people are going to look at, because there's often a bunch of colourful characters in one shot doing all kinds of stuff. And how do you draw the audience's eye to what you want them to see in that scene? You've got to sort of set it up somehow by bringing that character in earlier, but have it kind of feel like it's unfolding in real time. So, you know, it takes ages to do it, but it's a much more satisfying way of working when you do get a scene to work. And yeah, it just means that you can be far more ambiguous, because people can just make their own mind up about what they think it means and what they think of the band at the various stages, and without the voiceover sort of telling them. Like, I find it quite annoying when I hear a program with a voiceover telling me that I'm supposed to be laughing at somebody. It makes me sort of take a step back from the film. Because if someone says, like, I don't want to think what they're telling me to think, I want to just watch it for myself and make my own mind up.
Mm. No, I thought it worked quite well in that respect. And it's definitely one of those kind of similar to the Bros documentary. I'm sure you watched that.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it.
So it's similar.
I loved it.
In the way that, you know, you can watch it again and again. I think this is the same, where you notice different things and kind of, yeah, just take it all in again kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a clever idea making that film. It was so clever because they were so famous, but you didn't know anything about them. But they were everywhere, but they were cardboard cutouts and literally knew nothing about them. So just being introduced to them at all was interesting. And then they're really funny. And and they have a sort of mad, complicated relationship, but it completely makes sense as they reveal. Yeah, it's a fantastic film.
And just in terms of the drug use as well, obviously quite candid in terms of that. But like, I guess a channel like Bravo was all for that kind of thing.
Well, you know, we deliberately held it back. Like, we didn't want it to just be just constant drug taking. I think once you've seen it, you know it's happening, and there's no need to just constantly show it because it would be boring and a bit sort of crude, maybe. I don't know. I think you. But then one of the interesting things about them at the time was that, you know, you suspected that bands were doing what bands want to do in their spare time, but nobody was so overt about it than they were. So it was kind of part of their act to be sort of blatant about the lifestyle. So you couldn't not have it. So we just wanted to just show it and move on. Because it is a bit, I mean, I think possibly alienate some of the audience to see that as well. I think some people don't want to see it. But then could you do a film about the Towers of London and not have that, when if you just Google them now, then you just see that was all part of the sort of image at the time.
Yeah, and it almost becomes a joke in itself, like the way they talk about it and stuff, like they make it seem very uncool, put it that way. It just becomes a bit of a joke the way they talk about it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, more so in the original TV series, it's had a really sort of amoral way of presenting it without judging it. But then you see what happens as a result. I mean, it's definitely not a pro-drugs film in that sense, because you can see how it can help you mess up at super high speed. That all sort of plays out. But we didn't want to sort of, we just wanted to be like, yeah, to not take a view on that, just to show what they were doing and let people make their own minds up. And then the way it's worked out, I guess it's kind of, like, I wouldn't be worried about my kids seeing it thinking it's going to encourage them to take drugs, because I think it shows you why you don't.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I was just interested in like people like the manager, Nathan, and PR officer Mike.
Yeah, Mike's my favourite character in the film.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he's just the perfect foil for them. And he just wants them to do, he just genuinely wants them to do really well. And it must have been so painful for him when they just ignore all of his great advice.
Yeah, when they talk about Radio 1, it's very funny. It's just it's just, well, they're definitely not going to play you again if you call them a cunt.
Yeah. So he was a massive music fan that just wanted to be close to music and see it at first hand. And he you know, worked his socks off to help them achieve their goal, and it must have been, well, probably just fascinating seeing it happen, but also, you know, you just need to have the patience of a saint to continue picking yourself up and laying on the next thing. But then also, you know, he was press officer and they got loads of press, So he was doing a good job when they were a band that people wanted to write about at that time.
Hmm.
So is it James Blunt that did You're Beautiful? It is, isn't it? So that was the big record of the year when we were filming them.
Right,
I think that's a really good example of what the normal star was like. If you watch the video, the type of song that is in it, his baggy jeans and T-shirt, and just to see how, you know, against the grain they were at that moment.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually had a point, Mike, I think, when, is it the German promoter kind of called off the tour? And it's like, well, he should know what he's getting involved with, really.
yeah, no, it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Then, yeah, like, there's this theme of, you know, Derek and Donnie being bullied as kids, which, when they first start talking about it, it's quite endearing. And then you think, oh, right, yeah, kind of understand why they're fighting all the time or sticking up for themselves. But then, obviously, there's a bit of another side to that, obviously, at the end when, you know, they're blatantly bullying Rev. So I thought that was quite interesting in terms of, yeah, it's like a double side to that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those tools are really, I mean, this must be something that you hear about all the time, that you have to, it's impossible not to fall out with people when you're put in that situation, and tempers flare, and people who, if you just had a normal friendship with them, would never do your head in. If you're stuck in that kind of claustrophobic environment with them for ages, then you do end up falling out. And I think that they just, you know, that split emerged in the band, and I think they were just really offended that the other guys didn't seem to want to hang out with them, but that they couldn't express it like that, so they just didn't want to like act like that, talk like that, so it just became more and more of a thing until it just sort of exploded. But I think behind it was just feeling rejected by your mates and getting really emotional about it when you've been all stuck together in a tight environment, but also you're sort of getting hammered every night, so that just makes you feel more anxiety, doesn't it, and paranoia.
Yeah, and they said like the lack of in Japan, like the lack of access to drugs was actually one of the catalysts as well, which is quite mad.
Yeah, that they're on a massive sort of come down as well.
Yeah. But yeah, like obviously, yeah, when it gets to the reunion type of things, like. The speech from Rev is great. It's so captivating when he's, I think you show him, yeah, the moments in Japan, and he has like this really viscerally angry moment where he explains exactly what he thinks, and it's great. I've watched it a few times.
Yeah, so first up, let me say that Glenn did that. I wasn't in the room. It's a fantastic interview, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's so genuine. And you're just glued to it. As he gets more and more angry, you're just sort of on the edge of your seat. It's really, really good. And then, yeah, so I think that it was painful for all of them that we were using that fight scene clip, but it justifies itself because you see that, you know, if people can forgive each other or anything, it's amazing that they could do that and forgive each other. And you sort of see how... that forgiveness is really important for everybody concerned, the people doing the forgiving and the people being forgiven. It's just a massive positive thing. And if you don't show how horrific it was, then there's no power behind that. So it's quite brave of them to let us do it at all, given how bad some of them look in that Japan fight scene.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, I think that's my single favorite thing about the film. Like if you were doing a drama and you had a forgiveness theme in the drama, it's not like reality where you can see, wow, you know, like you can forgive, someone can be forgiven when they behave that badly. It's a really amazing thing to see, and that has to be sort of real documentary for it to be real. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's quite impressive. I mean, I don't want to give loads away really, but, you know, for him to go from feeling like that to, you know, it seems like he cracked on with them straight away as soon as he saw them, he was getting on with them. So, yeah, it kind of showed you that bond they had, really.
Yeah, because it's that thing that proper long-term friends, when you see them again, you haven't seen them for years, you just pick up where you were before, which is basically what happened once they'd kind of all got their apologies in.
I was just interested in, I can remember on YouTube as well, as that fight with the American fella.
Yeah.
But I noticed you cut that out of the film. Was it just because it didn't make it, or was there a reason behind that?
Well, yeah, they asked us to.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I didn't want to because I really like it. And but I wanted to try to stay friends with them. So they asked...
What, the band, is it, do you mean?
Yeah. They just didn't... I think they thought it made them look terrible and maybe there'd be some legal stuff came of it later. I don't agree with either of those things, but that's what they thought. And they, as part of the film sort of access process, they could watch the film and, you know, ask for things. And we just decided that it'd be better to take a few hits for the, you know, in the hope that the overall relationship would be better, you know. But you're right. I mean, it's maybe, you know, it's a shame to have taken it out because it's just a really mad moment, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think they're actually... I know, like, I don't know, I suppose they're gang up on him a little bit, but it's actually fair enough, like, he's talking to him like knobheads, yeah.
Well, yeah, because the policy was that they didn't go around starting fights. The policy was if someone shouts abuse at us, we're not just going to let it go. We'll call them out on it. And you see that clearly happening. They're just hanging out doing their own thing. He starts shouting a load of abuse at them, expecting them to just take it, but they don't take it. They come and sort of front him out about it. And you see all that in the scene.
Mm.
And then you also see how the brothers are inseparable. And if you try and take on one, you're going to get both of them.
Yeah. We even got that with Japan, even with like the rest of the band, when they're fighting in Japan. You see that, like a real good example of that when, you know, there's that split between the band. And as soon as any kind of scuffling breaks out, the brothers really join together again. And it's like, I don't know, yeah, it's almost like... just built into the minute to just immediately just rise up against anyone.
Yeah, you see it, don't you? A few times in the film that it's just a pre-programmed reality that will never change.
What was their upbringing? I remember in Big Brother, when Donnie went in, there was Leo Sayer in there. And I remember Leo Sayer saying to Donnie, oh yeah, you used to come round to my house as a kid and we used to play piano or something. Did they have quite like a good upbringing kind of thing? I don't know.
Well, they were born in Liverpool, and then their dad got a job in sort of the Chalfont area, which is quite a posh area. And so they moved from, I think, inner city Liverpool into one of the poshest parts of the country.
Oh, right, okay.
Which may account for the bullying, having a sort of thick Scouse accent. So they kind of got uprooted and put in a really lovely part of the UK where a lot of celebrities live.
Right, okay.
But they're not from sort of... posh roots, as they were accused at the time by the tabloids.
Right. Because
the tabloids just want to attack you on whatever they think is going to be the most painful thing. So, they're posh. and quoting school teachers saying they tried really hard at school and handed the homework in on time. It's the way that you try to undermine.
Yeah.
Someone with that accent. Yeah, I had when the TV series was out, I had journalists ringing me up and quizzing me about them, and I explained exactly where they were really from, what they were really like, and they just took absolutely no notice and just printed their posh.
Yeah, so when Donnie was doing things like Buzzcocks and Big Brother, was that, had the series already finished by then, or was it anywhere beneficial to what you were doing?
The series had finished by then. And he'd just become sort of notorious. So we weren't working together at that time. And I think they were still signed, but not doing anything because they'd, you know, you saw them fall out in Japan. But, you know, there was an appetite to get Donnie on TV because he'd become a tabloid character. He'd been on the front page of The Sun a few times and some of the other tabloids. So, yeah, he just sort of went down that... Ali.
Yeah. And then you talked about, like, you know, there is some endearing moments, and especially one with I forgot the bassist's name.
Tommy Brunette.
Tommy, yeah. Where, you know, it's hard to believe how... I couldn't believe he was serious at first when he was contemplating eating the KFC off the floor because he had no money. You know, he's having a race with those kids down the street and stuff. It's all pretty quite endearing. I can't believe they had that little money, really.
Yeah, because it's a bit that those, I think a few of the commentators say that there is something sort of fur coat and no knickers about that stage of your career as a band where you're living on tiny handouts from the record company. but you've got to, you need to be seen and you're getting invited to stuff, but struggling to pay the bills at the same time. I think that's pretty common. Do you find that on the podcast? That must be pretty common in the industry.
Yeah. Like, I guess the period we're revisiting, it's kind of the last period where money was being thrown about a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a big drop off for bands all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it costs a lot. Well, it used to cost a lot to record stuff and market it, and then the bands would just get a little bit of pocket money. And like a lot of other industries, a few select people hoover up all of the cash, and then everybody else is sort of scratching around, struggling to pay the bills.
Is there anywhere, I was wondering, is there anywhere you can actually watch the original episodes?
Not at the moment, but hopefully at some point, yeah. We're still trying to work out what to do with them, and we still have them.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. I suppose it's a double-sided question. Is there any standout moments, like what's your big standout moment from filming with the band? And is there anything you would do differently?
You mean standout from the fun of being there or of the results of watching it and thinking, I really love that?
I think I've been being there. I mean, you mentioned before about how memorable the gigs were. I just wondered if there were any like particular memorable moments from filming.
The first time I worked with them personally, we told you about when we first met in that fight, didn't we? And then it took ages to get the access. And then the first thing I did with them was to go to South by Southwest to sort of test some filming with them. And the first night they graffitied my door in the hotel room and were like banging on the door, trying to kick it down at about 3 a.m. And that was when I realized what I got myself into. That it's all very well having sort of all the madness on camera, but I was going to be living it as well. Yeah. So that was quite a memorable moment. You know what I mean? Realizing what you'd let yourself in for, basically.
Is that one of those weird things where it's like, that actually means you like you kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. But who knows what's going to happen next?
Yeah. And yeah, is there anything you would do differently about either the filming or anything really?
No, not really. I think it is what it is. I think it was a wild ride and we've known them for a long time, so we've had a lot of chance to adjust things along the way. And I really, really like the film. So, if you do something and you've got like a time pressure deadline and it all gets done really quickly, you can look back on it a few months later and think, well, now I've had a chance to think about it. I would do all this stuff differently. But that hasn't been the story with these guys because it started in 2006. So we've sort of refined it as we've gone along.
And yeah, obviously the screening next week in London that people can buy tickets for, but how is it being rolled out after that?
Not sure. We haven't worked out what the plan for to make it an international smash. Yes.
I think it's got legs big time, to be honest.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate it.